Heidi is now the pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in the Upper Side of New York for 19 years, the minister of Transfiguration Lutheran Church in the Bronx. I just want to say that Heidi will tell you more about her story presently. If we are, in a sense, celebrating Tim Gehringer's work as a fresh way of doing theology, indeed as a way of reconnecting the theological enterprise to lived experience, I think it's also important to acknowledge the power of such memoirs as Breathing Space to reach a level of depth and detail in experience through probing theological kind of analysis, but also through beautifully crafted prose, certainly as an example of a fresh kind of theological writing. So thanks for being here, and we look forward to the afternoon.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm honored to be here, and I hope, I realize that New York is in some ways an atypical situation, but it seems like the more specific we get in any context, sometimes it has universal application, so I hope that will be true. The way I decided to divide up the time is to first spend time talking about the South Bronx, and probably most of that is connected to my book, but not totally. And then we'll have some discussion, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about the context now where I am in Manhattan and have discussion for that. I think I'll begin with an English poet, T.S. Eliot, who you've heard from already. When the stranger says, "What is the meaning of this city? Do you huddle close together because you love each other? What will you answer? We all dwell together to make money from each other? Or this is a community." I decided to use a biblical story as, because I'm really first and foremost a preacher, a biblical story as a way to organize my reflections. It's not something I used in my book. It's this section you have from Numbers, and you don't have to read along with me, but you can if you like. In my experience in the South Bronx, the story of building has really been inseparable from the story of land. And it's equally true in my present context in Manhattan, where it's actually not only an issue of land rights, but even air rights, which I'll talk about later. The story in Numbers is one that we used actually as part of a community organizing action that we did in our neighborhood in a kind of walkabout campaign in the Bronx. And it's already been raised that there could be some problematic aspects with the whole story of conquest of the land and land issues in the Middle East. But in the context in which we used it in the South Bronx, it was very much a story of hope and liberation. The Lord said to Moses, "Send men," and I'm leaving the patriarchal language at this point, but Numbers has a very powerful, radical departure from patriarchal story in the five daughters of Zelophehad, which I'm actually going to preach on, so we'll get into that. But send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the Israelites. From each of their ancestral tribes, you shall send a man, everyone a leader among them. The passage talks about these ancestral tribes, and I find helpful, and it was useful for us in the Bronx to think the view of scholars who see these tribes possibly as beginning as foreigners in Egypt and others who were alienated from a political establishment and royal economy that left them dispossessed and poor, even as their labor and their taxes were building great cities. Related to that is the idea that some of these groups of outsiders were called the Aperu or Hebrews, and depending on the source, the thought that they were either nomadic, rebellious, outlaws, raiders, servants, slaves, or migrant workers. So on the one hand, we can see in Exodus that the Hebrews were desired for cheap labor, therefore they set taskmasters over them, they built supply cities for Pharaoh, And on the other hand, their growing numbers were a threat, so that the Egyptians began to dread the Hebrews. In the early hours of the morning in Farmingville, Long Island, laborers were still sleeping in a small house, about several dozen tenants, 30 tenants, when town authorities raided the dwelling and evicted all the sleeping people from their home without notice. "We were just thrown out on the street," said Benito Martinez. "Others from my house were out working or standing on the corner waiting for work and were not even allowed in to get their clothing." The Reverend Alan Ramirez from a nearby church held up a small dog. "If 30 dogs had been found living in the house, the county or town would have found homes for them. But these immigrants were treated worse than dogs. The Egyptians began to dread the Hebrews." It was also in Farmingville that one night a group of local teenagers firebombed a house in which a family of five Mexicans were asleep in their beds. And in the same town, that two young men, one of them only 19, were lured into an abandoned building with the promise of construction work and then attacked with a crowbar, shovel, and knife. "Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, or they will increase." Scholars think that the biblical Hebrews, as landless aliens grouped together in tribes during their migration from Egypt, where, like many undocumented workers today, they built cities they could not settle in, and were traveling to Canaan with the belief in the promise that it would be a land where they could settle and build. They came to the border of Canaan as refugees from Egypt, bringing with them this powerful, life-changing story of a God who hears the cries of the oppressed and afflicted and accompanies them. And perhaps there were others in the Canaanite underclass who were also drawn to this story and became incorporated into these tribes. When congregations in the South Bronx read and reflected on this numbers story, the churches identified with these ancestral tribes from which Moses is sending out leaders to spy on the land. They identified with those who felt alienated from the established political order and economy that control the land and virtually every access to built environment. If Egypt had its pharaoh, New York City had Robert Moses. Moses, a name of unsurpassed irony, was the larger-than-life New York City state, a city and state official whose vast array of public works projects completely transformed the built environment of New York City. Moses altered the shoreline, creating 15,000 new acres of land. He built all but one of the major roads and highways in and around the city. And I'm just going to say this list, even if it doesn't mean anything to you, because the list says something. He built the major Deegan Expressway, the Van Wyck Expressway, the Sheridan Expressway, the Buckner Expressway, the Gowanus Expressway, the Prospect Expressway, the Whitestone Expressway, the Clearview Expressway, the Throgsnick Expressway, the Cross Bronx Expressway, the Brooklyn-Queens Expressway, the Nassau Expressway, the Staten Island Expressway, the Long Island Expressway, the Harlem River Drive, and the West Side Highway. The five boroughs of New York City are all islands except for the Bronx, and there are seven large bridges built since 1931. Some of them are anchored by towers 70 stories tall. All seven were built by Robert Moses. He built, just among some of the better known, he built Lincoln Center, he built Shea Stadium. When Shea Stadium opened, he said, "When the emperor opened the Colosseum in 80 AD, he could have felt no happier than I today." He built hundreds of thousands of apartments, 700 playgrounds, 288 parks and zoos, 673 tennis courts, baseball diamonds, beaches, essentially the shape of New York City as we know it. I'm not an expert in this, but it seems to me that few people in the world have had such an impact on the built environment. And much of what Robert Moses built is enjoyed by millions and millions and millions of people from all over the world. But at what cost? Another poet, Neruda, wrote, in his poem on Machu Picchu, stone within stone, and man, where was he? Did you lift stone upon stone on a groundwork of rags, coal upon coal, and at the bottom, tears? Fire in the gold, and in the gold, the red trembling drop of blood? It seems to me that as we've already been talking about, those questions are crucial for any just built environment. One of Moses's projects, building one of the expressways, just one of them, was preceded by the slum clearance project in the 1950s. His idea was that certain areas of Manhattan, he wanted to build middle class housing, and in order to do that, he just had to move out poor people. So he just had them all moved out. People could fend for themselves in terms of where they were going to find housing, except that the poorest people were moved into the South Bronx. In the words of the Manhattan Borough president at the time, he said, "My God, they're hounding the people out like cattle. Tens of thousands, indeed hundreds of thousands of people were thrown out of their homes by Moses with very little provision for relocation, except the poorest were steered to the South Bronx." Then, right at that time when there was this huge influx of poor people into one concentrated area, he oversaw the construction of the Cross Bronx Expressway, which ripped through the South Bronx and displaced 60,000 families, bulldozing about not higher than six-story, but solid six-story apartment buildings and businesses were just simply torn down. Nobody organized against this because nobody believed that it would happen. Nobody believed that good buildings, you know, that were in great condition, populated, thriving neighborhoods would just be bulldozed. So there was an intense concentration of overcrowded housing and poverty, and that's began to lead naturally to increased crime and violence and drug use in the following decade. Property values dropped, and so landlords saw that through arson they could recoup their losses, and between 1970 and 1975 alone, there were 70,000 documented fires, not one arson conviction.
Bronx alone?
In the South Bronx, 70,000 fires between 1970 and 1975. Then, in 1976, along came Roger Starr, whose title, these titles are telling, New York City's Administrator for Housing and Urban Development. He announced a plan called Planned Shrinkage, which was cutting back all city services in the South Bronx. Police, fire, ambulance, closing schools, closing hospitals, to quote unquote accelerate the drainage of the most battered sections of the South Bronx and take the money that would be saved from all these public services and put them into better communities. 500,000 people moved away around that point, and the Bronx really hit bottom and became what, you know, it's kind of a infamous international vision of a badly built environment. Walter Brueggemann described wilderness as a space away from ordered land, a historical form of chaos. It could not be more apt for what the Bronx became at that point. The New York City, another Department of Housing Preservation and Development, then added, if things could get any worse, insult to injury. When my husband and I first moved into our parsonage in the Bronx, many of the neighboring buildings around us had been burnt out, were abandoned. The lower windows were either covered with concrete or open, you know, gaping holes, but all the top floors, the windows were covered with metal decals that were painted with beautiful, kind of window scenes, curtains or Venetian blinds or shutters. Some had plants. A few would have a cat. Now, clearly this was not for anybody that lived in the South Bronx, because on street level, what you saw was this devastation, and then you looked up and there were these weird paintings on all the windows. Somebody said that maybe the people of the South Bronx should put pictures of steak on their refrigerators. The mayor at the time was Ed Koch, and this was his explanation. In a neighborhood, as in life, a clean bandage is much, much better than a raw or festering wound. Now, the purpose of these quote-unquote bandages was so that people driving on the Cross Bronx Expressway, which was built so people didn't have to have any connection with the Bronx itself, they drove over it. When they looked out the windows of their cars, they did not have to be upset by seeing the devastation around them. From the distance, and they could only see the tops of the buildings, it looked like there were people living there in lovely buildings with curtains and plants and cats. The very structure of this built environment in every way, in every single way, fostered alienation and the breakdown of community and society. This kind of urban planning and building created a huge swath of suffering. People alienated from the rest of the city geographically, economically, socially, and spiritually. And in addition, this planned shrinkage led to the literal shrinkage of air rights, not the kind of air rights that are now selling for $430 a square foot in Manhattan, which I'll talk about. But that's what air costs in Manhattan, if you'd like to know, $430 a square foot. But the right of human beings to breathe. The configuration of the built environment led to the literal shrinkage of breathing space itself in terms of children's airways in their throats and lungs, with more children dying of asthma than any place in the country. And some of that is due to an environment of poverty, but it was the biggest contributing factor was the building in that neighborhood of facilities for waste, for basically other people's garbage. Sewage treatment, waste reprocessing, recycling plants, incinerators burning hazardous waste from around the city. A terrible example of environmental racism. 70% of all the sewage from the entire city of New York is processed right there. Most of the hazardous hospital waste was incinerated there until we were able to have that shut down. A local hospital there counted in 1 year 15,000 visits, 2,500 admissions, and 22 deaths a year just from asthma. The sewage plants and waste recycling plants were all in an area called Hunts Point, which is in the heart of the South Bronx. It's a major transportation artery. Most of the food that comes from around the country and is trucked into New York comes through Hunts Point. It's also packed with waste transfer facilities, metal scrap yards, and all of this was designed thanks to Robert Moses. Well, enough about Robert Moses. The tribes of God in the South Bronx resonated with the call of another Moses. The Lord said to Moses, send men to spy out the land of Canaan. From each tribe you should send a leader. At first the church where I was called Transfiguration seemed short on leaders, at least leaders that were open to spying out the land around them. The feeling was they'd seen enough. It was better to close your eyes, to close your doors, and try and find some peace within, because it certainly wasn't without. The church had been through its own shrinkage during this period, as had almost all the churches and institutions around it if they hadn't closed. The congregation had actually begun as part of a demographic movement in the 1920s of many Puerto Ricans moving to New York City. And at first, the members of Transfiguration following that movement who were Puerto Rican, moved into borrowed space in Spanish Harlem. And then in the 40s, following a move to the South Bronx, the German, Irish, and Italian immigrants were leaving the South Bronx, and African American and Puerto Ricans were moving in. The Bronx was enjoying a post-war boom. There were a lot of manufacturing jobs. It was a really a thriving working class neighborhood. There was a German Lutheran church right in that neighborhood, and the Germans were moving out as the Puerto Ricans were moving in. So it seemed like a really natural thing that the Puerto Ricans could buy the church from the German, the Lutheran, but that was not to be. One immigrant group refused hospitality to the other one, even though they were all Lutheran. And that led the members of Transfiguration to purchase their own little piece of land on Prospect Avenue, which at that point really felt like a little piece of the promised land. It was their first place where they could build their church, which flourished until everything I described with Robert Moses and urban planning and in the Bronx. And at that point, the members of the church went from feeling settled and proud parts of the community to feeling like aliens who were alienated in a place that had once been home. The church got smaller and smaller. There was a pastor who'd been there for 40 years left. No pastor stayed more than 2 years for 15 years. Then there were 4 years of vacancy before I came. The sense of alienation was not only from the decisions that were made in terms of all the built environment around them that had really destroyed the environment in every possible way, but also a sense of alienation from the church's own neighbors. It was right at the height of the crack epidemic, which was huge. One in five adults was HIV positive in our zip code. There were far more, the only public art was memorials to dead, to murdered teenagers. The only flowers were on sidewalk memorials to dead teenagers. One book that I highly recommend, it's called Torture and Eucharist by William Cavanaugh. I don't recommend you read it on a plane. I was sitting next to someone, I don't know what they, not this trip, but they were reading something a little lighter. I also read lighter things, but that day they said, oh, what are you reading? Oh, well, you have a brown paper wrapper on Torture in the Eucharist. what are you reading? But this book uses Chile as an example under a dictatorship and talks about the fact that torture was not used to get information out of people, but to alienate people from one another, to create an atmosphere of fear. He says, William Cavanaugh, it was used as by the military dictatorship as a social discipline to atomize and scatter all social bodies which stand between the individual and the state. And he said that the church failed because the church failed, which is what we've been taught, to see itself as a body, but rather as the soul of society, giving over the bodies to the state, and that the church disappeared through its own ecclesiology. And it was the fear in the South Bronx had a very similar effect on, certainly on the congregation of causing this kind of social dismemberment, separating people one from another in afraid of one another, and creating the church really participated in the state's the city's politics, which by keeping people separated from one another and afraid of one another kept people from joining together and working effectively for change. And this book is really wonderful, and it talks about the Eucharist really as a reconnecting and one of the first things that we did, which I talked about in my book, had to do with our doors, because the doors were really a sign of the of disconnection with the church and the building and the community. It was covered with graffiti. And when I came as a sign of, you know, new beginnings, the members painted over the doors with this can of red paint, which I found in my office. And I thought, why did they leave the can of red paint in my office? Well, because every day there was, you know, I'd walk to the church, there was new graffiti, I'd paint over it. And, you know, finally I thought, this is getting a little boring. And I, in talking with youth in the neighborhood had many, many youth and children, found young people interested in art, and I invited them to paint on the front doors. And that really became a transitional point where, even when the doors were closed, they were proclaiming a new kind of openness, and that the youth of the community really had a vision for transformation, that it wasn't just a dead end. And as Lutherans, the Reformation on the doors was a big thing for us. But that was the beginning of this reconnection, and I think as we've talked some about, the built environment really depends on the human architecture of the city being, it depended for us on being rebuilt as living stones, reconnecting, rebuilding relationships, and community organizing. And I learned about that in theology, but community organizing really provided techniques of doing that. One of the things related to the, you know, Moses text, the Numbers text, sending a leader from each tribe and finding these leaders. And the community organizing idea of finding leaders wasn't completely satisfying to me, because we were taught to really identify natural leaders. And I was encountering a lot of people that didn't necessarily seem to be natural leaders, but I believe theologically we are all leaders, that every person is made in the image of God and every person has gifts for leadership. And one of the things that we did was, in terms of reconnecting with people, was form a women's group. It was mostly single mothers that were struggling with a lot of issues of poverty and abuse and addiction. And as the women who were very isolated began connecting with one another, sharing each other's stories, listening together, praying together, and also connecting with stories of spiritual ancestors. A lot of stories of women in the Bible that often are not given prime time in our churches or stained glass, and even stories of women that do not have happy endings, some of the abused women in the Bible. The fact that there was a story like that in the Bible was very empowering and helpful for people. One of our leaders, and I told her story in my book, I won't go through the whole story, but Bernice, her real name is Dolores, I'll just call her Dolores. But Dolores did not come as someone you would say, now there's a leader. She came to get some free toys that she was gonna sell to get drugs. But what made the difference was that when she came that day, she made a connection with someone who looked at her and sat with her and listened to her and prayed with her. And that, that made a difference. And then Dolores came to be part of the women's group. And then she felt connected to these stories of these biblical ancestors and to Jesus. And then the possibility of connecting to the larger community and connecting with other churches and groups to work for change for her children. And then the congregation made that kind of same move that Dolores made of feeling helpless, there's really nothing to do, to connecting, to reconnecting, to bringing God's order into this disordered environment. So Moses sent them from the wilderness of Paran, according to the command of the Lord, and all of them leading men among the Israelites. These were their names. From the tribe of Reuben, Shammua, son of Zachar. From the tribe of Simeon, Shaphat, son of Hori. From the tribe of Judah, Caleb, son of Jephunneh. Okay, I won't read it all. But each tribe, each name, The founding assembly of South Bronx churches began exactly like that. We had 2,000 people. We had just completed a sign up and take charge campaign where we had 100,000 signatures of people who said, I want to make a difference. And we had an agenda of different items that people wanted to work for change on, that different leaders from the congregations had gone out and spoken with 100,000 people. So when we had our opening assembly in 1987, each leader was named, kind of like naming each of these tribes. And it went like, in our case, my name is Dolores Johnson, and I'm a leader from Transfiguration. My name is Angel Bonilla, and I'm the pastor of Second Christian Church. Mi nombre es Rosa Madrigal, mi iglesia San Jerónimo. Each person, very much like in the biblical story. And one of the, an elderly woman, I remember standing up at that meeting with her cane and saying, I want to see people in the windows. You know, she was talking about these fake windows. Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan and said to them, go up there into the Negev and into the hill country and see what the land is like, whether the people who live in it are strong or weak, whether they are few or many, whether the land they live in is good or bad, whether the towns they live in are unwalled or fortified, whether the land is rich or poor, and whether there are trees in it or not. It seems that Moses is calling for an analysis of Canaan's demographics, economy, civic structures, and defense systems. Even though the leaders of the churches in the South Bronx had lived in the land for quite a while, being alienated from it, it was necessary to kind of scope it out with new eyes, to analytically look at it and see where is the weakness, where do we have a critical mass for this battle or that one, how is the city organized against us, where do we have allies, what assets do we have, what resources do we need. And Moses did not try to do this by himself. It's a broad-based effort, including leadership from all the different tribes. And we sought to do the same thing with many different congregations, many different denominations, and every tribe, leaders from different backgrounds and ethnicities. Be bold and bring some of the fruit of the land. Now it was the season of the first ripe grapes. Be bold. Claim your right to the fruit of the land. For the people in the South Bronx, in that context, that was a very liberating call. Not a call to be oppressors, but a call to liberation. We could not begin with a major housing initiative. We had, because in analyzing the lay of the land, we weren't ready for that. We had to begin with something small where people could try out their building capacity. And our group of women began with a supermarket action. As I said, about all the food was coming into New York City, not all of it, but the majority, through the Hunts Point Market, which was only blocks from the church, but almost none of the food, particularly the fresh food, stayed in the neighborhood. Much of the food stocked by local supermarkets was wilted, spoiled, even rancid. Numbers talks about ripe grapes. I mean, the grapes were uneatable. I remember the grapes. This was just business as usual, and it went unchallenged. Until the day came when the women marched into the supermarket wearing white jackets and buttons that said inspector. And they walked into the supermarket and began dumping rotten food into their baskets. And there was this flurry of concern. Who sent you? What kind of inspectors are you? My family sent me. I'm expecting the quality of food for my family. Will you feed this food to your family? The idea that these welfare mothers would rise up and challenge the unjust practices of these local markets was unheard of. And they made it clear to the manager that he would be hearing a lot more from them if nothing was done. And something was done. A number of the local markets cleaned up their act, and numbers of children and adults were able to eat healthier food because of it. But it wasn't primarily just about the taste of the food. It was also a taste of dignity. It was a taste of power to make a difference. sweeter in some ways than the plump ripe grapes. And of course, biblically speaking, and in this passage, grapes are always more than grapes. Our first actions, like the first ripe grapes in the story, were signs of more to come. So they went up and spied out the land from the wilderness of Zin to Rehob near Lebo Hamath, and they went up into the Negev and came to the Hebron, and Iman and Sheshai and Talmai and the Anakites were there. They came to the Wadi Eshkol, cut down from there a branch with a single cluster of grapes, and they carried it on a pole between the two of them. They also brought some pomegranates and figs. That place was called the Wadi Eshkol because of the cluster that the Israelites cut down from there. The image of two men carrying a cluster of grapes on a pole made to carry animals suggests a fullness way beyond what could be considered natural. Not even Miracle-Gro could produce grapes that big. My soul magnifies the Lord, sang Mary. And our leaders felt their natural powers magnified through the power of God. Dolores, who had felt powerless over a crack habit, and Felix, who had felt powerless as his daughter lay dying in the hospital emergency room without anyone paying attention, marched down the street to that same hospital to demand a state investigation into administrative corruption that left the hospital in such a shambles that babies were dying with formula bottles propped in their mouths because overbusy nurses didn't have time to care for them. Pastors who felt powerless and unsure of their ministry found strength to stand up to death threats because the owner of this hospital was a very violent person. This claiming the power of the promise of God changed people's way of seeing the environment. Even in this text from Numbers, it changed the name of the place because of the Israelites cutting down these grapes, that the place was named for that. At the end of 40 days, they returned from spying out the land, and they came to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation of the Israelites in the wilderness and brought back to them word to all the congregation, showed them the fruit of the land, said, "We've come to the land to which you sent us. It flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit." So at the end of 40 days, and of course 40 is an important number in the Bible, it suggests this time of preparation. At the end of the early relational meetings that we had, and actions and victories and evaluations, it was preparation for wider actions, wider relationships. We could, as these people did, look at what we did and what it tells us about the possibilities, the promise, the milk and honey. Well, it all sounds great. And then, yet, the people who live in the land are strong and the towns are fortified and very large. And beside, we saw the descendants of Anak there. But Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it." Then the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against this people, for they are stronger than we are." So they brought to the Israelites an unfavorable report of the land they had spied out, saying, "The land we have gone through as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people we saw in it are of great size. There we saw the Nephilim, the Anakites, come from the Nephilim, and to ourselves we seem like grasshoppers, and so we seem to them." There is an abrupt shift. Doubts and fears are rising to the surface. The immensity of the challenge seems overwhelming. Fresh fruit in the local supermarket is one thing. Taking on building codes, acres, trying to get acres of land to build housing for low-income people, confronting an entrenched educational system whose failures directly linked to a growing prison system where in New York, numbers of towns in upstate New York have been completely revitalized through the building of prisons, which depend on the raw material of children from the South Bronx to keep the economy going. That can be overwhelming. Anak and the descendants of Anak were looming in people's minds. And it says that the Anakites came from the Nephilim. Nephilim were the near mythic race of giants that are briefly talked about in Genesis, produced from an unnatural union of supernatural beings and mortals. The Nephilim and their descendants were seen as larger than life, and in contrast, the people feel their own potential dwarfed. To ourselves, we seem like grasshoppers, and so we seem to them, feeling literally belittled and internalizing this view of themselves. And that was an issue, an ongoing back and forth issue, certainly in the Bronx. It's possible that the Anakites were literally a race of tall people, but I read an interesting study where some archaeologists examined the skeletons of people who were, and I don't know how they knew they were Anakites, but the study said they were Anakites, and found that they were generally the same size as everybody else. Perhaps it's kind of like saying, well, Robert Moses put on his pants like everyone else, but yes, but you know, some people can feel larger than life. Instead of magnifying the Lord, the people are now magnifying the sons of Anak. And then with that, the size of the city's fortifications, the city's defense system, everything that's holding it up. Caleb insists the people can occupy the land, but now they're saying, we can't, we are powerless, buying into this identity. And at that point, it shifts the way people see everything. One minute it was a place of milk and honey, and now it's a land that devours its inhabitants, taking life rather than sustaining it. Now I realize so far I haven't said anything about building homes in the South Bronx and shaping the built environment in that way. And that's because for us, building up hope, building up relationships, building up the sense of power in the face of giants was inseparable from the physical rebuilding. South Bronx Churches was founded in 1987. The first foundation was not poured in the housing that we built until 1991. In the first phase, we built 512 homes and condominiums. The condominiums were a compromise related to scale. The city, people did not want condominiums. They wanted a home with a yard. But the city insisted for density issues that there had to be condominiums. And although they were all sold, those were much, much more difficult to sell. The second phase, we built 360 single family and two family homes. And a lot of people wanted, and that was a switch, wanted two family homes so that extended family members could live in part of it. And that those weren't completed until 1999. It took 12 years, and I would say it really took the effort of spiritual giants, because people had to identify parcels of abandoned land, go to weekly meetings to learn about land reclamation, land use regulations and procedures, construction financing, housing development. Our first attempt to claim a site that we really wanted, that seemed like the perfect site for the first homes, it was called Site 404. We had 8,000 people that came out and stood on that site and picked up pieces of the ground and held it up. Full of promise, but we did not get that land. It was given to a developer at much greater cost to the city and greater cost to the people who would eventually move there. And in that sense, it was a failure. But 8,000 people grabbing hold of a piece of ground to claim the land, standing together, Black, white, Latino, Roman Catholic, Baptist, Muslim, Lutheran, that was not a failure. That was a turning point. And that was the beginning of the construction of the homes. And the problem, I mean, the realistic kind of problems with bureaucratic barriers, with sewer department permit problems, attempted shakedowns, misrepresentation, threats, ridicule, and even after the construction, we had to pay some companies to take away the rubble. One of the companies buried the rubble, which we didn't find out until one of the foundations started to crack, because underneath was garbage. And that's the importance in this work, I think, of the solid foundation, a solid spiritual and theological foundation, because of the difficulty and the obstacles. Here in the story, the people just give up, they weep, they cry out, you know, would that we had died in Egypt or in the wilderness. Let's choose a captain and go back to Egypt. You know, organizing to go back to the past. That's something that's common in a lot of our churches, I'd say. And it comes out of a sense of hopelessness sometimes. So how do we nurture the kind of spirit modeled by Caleb? And I think this work is extremely difficult. Martin Luther King talked about the giant triplets. He talked about the giant, talking about giants, he talked about the giant triplets of racism, consumerism, and militarism. He said, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values when machines and computers, profit motives, and property rights are considered more than people. The giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. And I think that's a spiritual battle, not only against flesh and blood, because those giant triplets of racism, consumerism, and militarism shape so much of our built environment. At the end of the story, Moses and Aaron, Joshua and Caleb are responding to the despair of the people, and their first response is to repent, to tear their clothes. I think it's a repentance against worshiping the giant triplets, either by actively, willfully benefiting from them, or passively just giving up, which was more what was going on in the South Bronx. And then lifting up the promise again of God, the promise of this land that flows with milk and honey. And then the reaction. The reaction isn't what they would wish for. The whole congregation threatened to stone them. Using the material of building, the vernacular material there, the stones, to destroy rather than to build up life. And yet, it's not the last sentence. Then the glory of the Lord appeared at the tent of the meeting. And as we have so recently celebrated in our churches, the glory of the Lord has a way of appearing in the face of immovable stones. So I'm going to stop there for the Bronx part and see if there's anything you'd like to talk about.
So right, we can, thank you so much. We can take 15 minutes or so now and take a quick break and then come back.
Okay.
We have 15 minutes now. 15, is that what you want?
Questions or a break?
15 minutes to the discussion now and then Craig can start. Everybody's
I realized it was taking too long. We had to get land, we had to get a builder, and we had to get money. And we got no interest loans. We didn't, which were all paid back because people were buying the homes. We got $500,000 from the ELCA, Lutheran Church loan, $500,000 for the Roman Catholics, $800,000 each, two $800,000 from two Episcopal churches in Manhattan that each loaned $800,000. So we had about $3 million, which at that time was able to, use that. And then we defined our own builder who was willing to work with this kind of a project with a lower profit margin. We had to work with the city to get the land. The city gave us the land. We had to work with the city to get permits but there was no public funding.
Two things. One, just part of the story question. When you had that highly symbolic action, you get all these people together, and you're on this piece of land, everybody's holding up this wonderfully sacramental and connected to it and all this. I assume you're praying and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't work out.
Right.
So the first question I have is, as a leader, what did you do when you found out it didn't work out?
Well, because lift up the sense in which it was a success, because to this day people remember that. I mean, and that wasn't just like playing. It wasn't just like trying to convince people. Well, it really wasn't so bad. I mean, to this day, people remember that were there as a. It's just an incredible moment. It really, and the fact that we didn't get that particular piece of land, but that coming together kind of motivated people to keep fighting. So, and I think to keep, to talk about that and to lift that up. We had a similar, on a smaller level, a group of women, we were doing an education campaign, went across the street to meet with the principal, and they were really afraid and had done all this training and practice and went to meet the principal with some very simple questions about the school, and he walked out on them. And they came back and, it was like, it was a failure, but they were so angry. And then that became a tool for using that anger to say, we cannot be treated like this. So I guess.
So it's a way that people get emotionally closer to the thing, even if they don't get there that time?
I think so.
Okay. As a person, I've studied King Sum, and my former job before trying to start this community was trying to get a large, wealthy, more or less suburban church involved with issues of justice. And so what I really. Out of King's work, and I really appreciated so much in your book, and thought it's, if I may say so, your gift really, in a lot of ways, is this ability to find these highly symbolic actions that bridge the transcendent into people's lives and bring these moments together. Something I'm trying to learn as I'm going. So my second question related to all that is in this passage, the glory of the Lord changes perception, which then changes reality.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, we used to, Lee Stewart, who is an organizer there who has spoken here, we talk about when you come into the South Bronx, when people would come with cameras, it depends where you aim the cameras. I mean, it really all does to do with how we see things. Because even after we're doing wonderful things, people were doing wonderful things in the South Bronx, and groups of tourists would come and want to be taken. To see the worst. They wanted to see the worst thing. They weren't excited about seeing positive things. They wanted to see, the worst thing. I think I really like the, this year during Advent, I handed out magnifying glasses to the children about magnifying the Lord, but I really think that's true. To me, I mean, as a woman who's, had two children. I mean, that when Jesus was still invisible, Mary, God gives Mary this vision of, the vision of the future. I mean, it is eschatological, but it's also it's already and not yet. I mean, I think that's what our faith, I mean, I couldn't, I guess, keep going without that.
Hi, just about designing the houses that you built, like we've talked about design and its importance and making that human important. Tell us about that.
Well, I was thinking about that, you know, as I was listening, I was thinking, gee, I wonder if they could have been designed differently. I mean, I want to talk to Lee. I mean, because Lee is very, I don't know, I mean, ecologically, they're certainly not eco houses. I don't know, could they have been? You know, I don't know the economics of that, what that would have been, and we weren't. I mean, I think that they're really beautiful houses there, but I mean, we didn't have money for some,
sure.
You know. So I don't know. The thing and people. I mean, it's interesting about the gates because the way that people really made those houses their own was. Inside, but really outside the gardens, because this was the big thing to have a garden in the South Bronx, to have flowers that weren't about dead children. And I mean, the gardens are just, you know, incredible. And there people, and the decorations, you know, for different seasons.
Is that in front of the houses, the gardens?
Yeah, and in back, but the, no, the front was really, that you could show their garden. Yeah. And people are almost never in, when the weather's nice, I mean, if you, you know, people are always outside in the garden.
That was actually my question. I remember just my brief time in Brooklyn, the first year I was there was like 72, 73, four-story buildings, and the life on the street was as vibrant as what you described in the beginning of your book. And then, you know, now that block is all Nehemiah houses, and I don't even know what the street life is like. Is it, would you describe it as vibrant?
Oh, yes, I would. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm not familiar in Brooklyn, but yeah. In the Bronx, definitely. Yes?
Well, I think your struggle for words is a little bit unusual. There just seems to be a large gap between affordable housing and design.
Well, our second,
kind of funny, the
second set of housing we built is more attractive than the first. I mean, I think there was learning. Yeah.
Well, then my question for you is, what feature, you say the gardens were definitely a feature that bring light and speak of redemption. I wonder what other features do speak out of that architecture that's developing within the South Bronx that means something to the people and what you say are making of the life, the vibrancy.
Just to have a place, your own place to live. I mean, that's not dependent on, I mean, the whim of a landlord. I mean, a building that's clean, that you can control. I mean, people in these rundown buildings with landlords that don't care, where you have to go to court for months, where there's sewage leaking from the ceiling above you, where there's, you know, rats. I mean, to have a clean environment that you have a voice over what happens, that you're not just passively living somewhere and having all this stuff dumped on you, that's the huge difference.
Ownership
and control, power, a sense of control over your environment.
I think clean is probably a distinct cultural marker. I don't know, there's subtleties, but at least in LA, the Latino homes are extremely clean, and they think we're very messy. I mean, sort of, you know, middle class Caucasian. They my daughter's friends come over, and they're like, "Oh yeah, I heard your house was messy." And that, you know, that's just our cultural choice. But when you have to control your environment enough to keep it clean,
yeah,
that's real significant.
I just want to say that, you know, when I think about the built environment and think about actually when the question was first proposed, and we had to write a summary of it, and just kind of to the question that was asked you, when you find yourself getting out of a very dense situation, when you got people all around, just to be able to move into what is not just clean and affordable because of your but the ownership of it, bring that peace and bring that environment to live there. My house is not so different than anyone else, but because I'm comparing where I'm at now to where I used to be.
Oh, it's like a palace.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that peace and that shalom that come with that help create that environment, help create that continuity between you and the redemption process, because that piece is generated. You know, even though it looked like it may not be an Echo Mod house. I know Habitat did a good job with the houses. I'm in partnership with them. But even, like you say, do we want to take our affordability to create this other environment that we go to? So, you know, just ownership. That's breathing space.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good place to take a break.